Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Gun violence has become a fact of life in America, and much of it stems from a growing tendency to reach for a gun to solve a disagreement. The latest example before this morning in California was a local one. A week and a half ago, one 16-year-old student at Butler High School shot and killed another 16-year-old student. Bullying, we are told, may have been a motive, although police are discouraging that. In Huntersville, in Matthews, we really don't know. What we do know is the two disagreed over something that began the previous weekend, and that disagreement ended in tragedy for both individuals involved because a gun was used to solve a problem. The truth is, guns can never solve problems. They only make them worse. But all too often, they are the method of first resort in dealing with threats, slights, and disagreements. Following a much earlier shooting involving students from West Charlotte High in 1989, shaken friends and classmates formed a group called Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE. They've been working ever since to engage, empower, encourage, and educate young people on ways to prevent gun violence and resolve conflicts in a peaceful manner. Gary Wiert is a co-founder of that organization and joins us for the hour because we're going to spend this hour talking about conflict resolution, finding ways to resolve disagreements peacefully, and the need to teach those skills at a young age. Gary Wiert, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. It's an honor to be here.
Nice to have you here. We're also joined by CMS Bullying Prevention Specialist, John Councilman. Didn't know we had a Bullying Prevention Specialist, John. Welcome back.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And we're also joined, they're both in our Spirit Square studio, but joining us by Skype is Dr. Sarah Levins, Associate Professor of Psychology at UNC Charlotte, who is interrupting her vacation to be with us this morning, for which we are thankful. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I'm actually at a conference.
So. Okay. Well, all right. Well, interrupting your conference. Yeah. It was better my way. It sounded better my way.
I wish, exactly.
Gary, your organization, Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE, it started in response, as I said, to a local tragedy following shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary. Your organization joined forces with Sandy Hook Promise to expand your reach and try to prevent gun violence before it happens. But those shootings here continue, around the country they continue, witnessed this morning, in neighborhoods, in bars, in churches, in synagogues. Do you feel like, and you've been at this for a while now, do you feel like you're spitting into the wind?
At times I think I do, but I think hope is still in the chest, you know, and I...
Why do you feel that way? Because when you look at what happens in this country on a daily basis...
Yep.
It appears hopeless.
Well, we have to understand that, particularly with in schools, the schools reflect the community, and we can't keep the community out of the school. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's a lot of young people that have a very, very positive approach towards stopping violence, and they don't have a voice. And unfortunately, the other gets more exposure. And times have changed, Mike, in terms of the technology, and I think that's a key factor.
Talk about social media?
Yes. 30 years ago, when something happened, we didn't find out about it till a day or two later, but now you instantaneously find out about it, and people will act sometimes irrationally to the news and make judgments and, you know, move upon it, and it's just not healthy. And when you don't communicate with people, which the media today allows us not to have a face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact. And communication, if it's lacking, to me, is a lack of respect. And communication is a way that we show people respect. Hmm. And that's not something you can do with technology.
Do you think a lot of these shootings, these spur-of-the-moment shootings, that they were not necessarily planned, although somebody is carrying a gun and therefore it's available to them on a split second, a lot of these things, are they because of a lack of respect or a lack of perceived respect?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And many times we act irrationally. The one thing that keeps us the highest form of life is our ability to reason. Mm-hmm. But when we respond to emotions and feelings and let that override our rationality, then I think sometimes we make rash decisions and we make mistakes without thinking about the consequences.
Alex Orange was the name of the young man who died in that shooting in 1989. He was one of your students. You were a history teacher back then. And at his graveside, his mom vowed that senseless murders like her son's would not happen again in Charlotte, not to minimize her grief or her resolve or the movement that rose out of the ashes of that young man's death. But we've heard that before, and we continue to hear it. And yet, every day, this continues, every day. What's the root of the problem in your mind?
There's several things, Mike. I think we've created the perfect storm. We have a lack of parenting, I think, that's going on because I think we don't have that quality of parental involvement sometimes with the young people. I think we have the mental health issue. I think we have the availability of war weapons to the general public. I think we have just a general lack of respect.
It seems, and I don't believe that this is anecdotal, but it seems that more and more conflicts between people or groups of people are solved now with guns. In the past, they may have been solved by a shouting match or jostling people around or using a fist here or there, but now it gravitates toward the use of guns. How do you explain the escalation and the willingness to use a gun to solve what are usually petty grievances?
Well, I think a lot of times young people today don't understand the consequences of actually somebody dying. It causes consequences not just with the victim and the victim's family, but also the perpetrator's family. And I think they see that as a trump card. You know, they're video games, and I hate to bring it up, but now the latest research has shown that, you know, that has not helped because they can constantly act upon something and then, of course, tomorrow everything's fine, let's play it again, you know, and that's not reality. That's not what happens in life.
Yeah. John Councilman is here from CMS. He's a bullying prevention specialist there and a guidance counselor. I know that you cannot talk about the Butler High School shooting because it's an ongoing investigation, and CMS has been asked not to talk about it and have also been asked not to characterize it as a bullying incident now by police because they've found no evidence of that so far in their investigation. But guns are a problem at CMS. They have been for years. CMS constitutes 10% of the enrolled students throughout the state in public schools, but you constitute 20% of the number of guns found in public schools around the state. Usually, they are merely found on campus, as they were at Garinger last Tuesday and at Hopewell yesterday, I believe, in the possession of students perhaps, but on campus, not discharged. What is it about Charlotte or about CMS or both that has led us to this point?
You know, I don't have that answer. I mean, I think there's more questions than answers on this one. I know that we're going to be working hard within CMS as well as with our community to look at the issue, you know, try to answer those questions and come up with solutions. As of right now, we have a community that we know this is happening. And I want to take a step back with when we look at conflict, you know, conflict, and I'll quote one of my favorite authors, Barbara Caloroso, is needed, normal, and necessary. We all go through conflict. I think what we're talking about is how do we prevent that conflict from escalating, because once it escalates, you've got two groups or two people that are having the same ownership in this conflict, but when it escalates, it gets to a point of I must destroy the other person in order to win this conflict.
But isn't that going through our society at large? Isn't that the foundation of our politics right now? It's not enough that I win. I have to destroy you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, yes. It is a fabric
what
of
is
our
that
community.
About?
it starts with how do we get people to start to humanize one another, start to recognize that that person I'm in conflict with, you know, everyone has the potential to have a brother or sister or mother, father, grandfather. And when you're in conflict with somebody and you cannot resolve it in a peaceful way where both of us walk out with a win-win and you have to destroy that person, not having the emotional intelligence of understanding what you're doing not only to that person but to a human being is lacking.
Dr. Levins, let me bring the psychologist into this because this seems, he just used the term emotional intelligence, and that seems to be something that we lack in society at large now. We have stopped growing in our emotional intelligence, so everything is magnified way out of proportion, and we've just become angry and bitter and vindictive. Why?
That is a big, excellent question, because there's really no simple answer. One of the things that people don't realize is how emotions are contagious. And this is something that there's much more experience with now, because through social media, we can see how the emotions of others and the emotions on social posts, they affect us. But that's actually much more pervasive than social media. It is something that if we come home from our work and we're stressed, then we communicate to our children. They see how we regulate our own emotions. And if we are frustrated and tense, then that will communicate to them that this is sort of an appropriate action. But the total pervasiveness of other people's emotional experiences, the challenges, that we're having right now in our society, these are things that really, this requires a different type of skill set. And this moves beyond just conflict resolution in this sort of person interpersonal sense to this broader way of managing one's own emotions. And the challenge for this is that this is actually sort of it hasn't reached the heights that it has right now. So we're, as a society, figuring out, well, wait, how do we actually do with this really high level of emotionality? And if we think back, stress has been looked at and its effect on health, and they had the big movements in terms of stress and effect on individuals at health, type A personality. And now we see that the same type of understanding here, where this sort of pervasion of stress and how it affects people, you're having this pervasiveness of emotion, and it's much more core and raw. You know, stress is oftentimes associated with work, but the core raw emotions that everybody's feeling, those are really hard to navigate and control.
I only have 30 seconds in this segment. Yeah. I just want to know from you, what has increased our stress levels, in your opinion?
Oh, I might need more than 30 seconds for that.
Well, that's my specialty. I always ask difficult questions with no time left to answer them. So I'll let you think about that, and we'll come back on the other side and get an answer to what you think why our stress levels are rising. And we'll talk more about the use of guns to solve problems when they just create more and unsolvable problems when you use them. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about conflict resolution, and a term I have not heard yet, but I just heard it from one of our guests, conflict management, which we'll talk about in a second. Gary Wirt is the person I heard that from. He is the co-founder of Students Against Violence Everywhere, a Charlotte organization that has now spread itself around the country, as a matter of fact. John Councilman is here, bullying prevention specialist with Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, and Dr. Sarah Levins, associate professor of psychology at UNC Charlotte. And just before the break, you mentioned several things that might be causing this rise in gun violence and this constant feeling of being angry and whatever it is we're going through. And you mentioned stress. And I asked you, what do you think has raised our stress levels so much in recent years?
Well, stress at a basic level is when you experience stress when your own, the event is more than your own capacity for coping. And so that's a sort of basic broad definition. And right now, one of the primary contributors to this increase in threat is the broad array of threat perceptions that we have. So now more than ever with social media, with the news, with we can know what's going on all over the world in an instant, around the corner. There's negative events are transferred, you know, across news and social media much faster than positive events, and that increases our overall threat perception. So we are now in this heightened vigilance for threat. This is something that we're evolutionarily sort of trained for as human beings and protecting ourselves, and that our heightened perceptions of threat are going to be what is going to cause us to then have a decrease our ability to cope. We're going to feel more likely to feel overwhelmed. And Gary mentioned earlier that we have this sort of lack of perceived respect when we interact with individuals. And I think that could also be reframed as this instead of a lack of perceived threat, or in addition to a lack of perceived threat, is that there is more threat perception. That instead of being a lack of respect, it's actually the perception of threat.
How much of this growing perception of threat is not just being driven by the fact that we see things that we couldn't see before because we didn't have the technology to see it, versus certain media outlets who make money on reporting over and over and over and amplifying threats that are maybe threatening, but not to the degree that they have built them up to be, and by our own leaders who find a way to capitalize on those threats to their own gain? How much of it is that versus the reality of those threats?
Oh, it's very much the overplaying of these events. We, by overplaying them and restating them, excuse me, they modify our ability to detect how risky these events are, what the likelihood of actually having them occur to us. And as humans, we're not that good at that, period. But by playing these events over and over again and magnifying them, and when these news agencies or social media outlets, when they are rehearsing and playing these events, what they also do is they are communicating this upregulation or the suggestion to increase your emotional response to these events. And that then basically tells us we should heighten our reactivity, and that's going to increase our threat perception and increase our stress and lower our ability to cope.
So bringing this conversation back to schools and back to guns and guns in schools and in the hands of students who may bring them to school, whether they use them or not, because of their own perceived threats, and I guess some of that comes from the examples they see in media, in games, in music, in movies and television, etc. When, John, when students are found with a gun on a school campus, do you ask them why they brought the gun? Why they have it in their possession?
Once they're found with a gun or any violation of the code of conduct, you know, an investigation is done, and that's part of the investigation.
So I know you can't be specific, but when you ask the question, why do you have a gun? Why do you bring a gun to school? What are the common answers?
I'm sure that we could, there's many different reasons, and I think that it's hard for me to speculate on why a child would feel the need or a student.
What have they told you? Don't speculate. Tell me what they told you.
There's reasons based on conflict in the community. There's reasons that they just feel that that's part of providing them some sort of power, you know, and feeling safe, bringing it in. And like I said, and I think Gary said it before, schools are a reflection of the community. Community is part of the school. And if they're bringing in a gun, there's a reason for that feeling of them needing it, whether it's at the school or, you know, in the community.
And Gary Wirt, you used the term off the air a moment ago, conflict management, that conflict resolution is an ideal that we may never reach. And we certainly don't have very many examples of it in society today, but we can manage. We can agree to disagree. Hard to do if you have a gun in your pocket.
It's true. Young people are not being exposed to good examples of conflict being resolved or managed. And one of the beautiful programs we used to work with a lot was the peer mediators, where we would train young people to sit down and mediate differences between kids.
Right.
But I want to jump a little further ahead and say, in terms of the gun being there, we've got to do a better job in the causations of why the gun came in. And you were asking that. And one thing that we do now with the SAVE and the Sandy Hook Promise is we have something called Know the Signs. And there are certain things that we can educate the young people to be part of, the administration, the counselors, the teachers, to look for kids that are feeling somewhat alienated or somewhat isolated. We have a program called Starts with Hello. You got that kid that sits over there in the cafeteria by himself. Well, that's a red flag. Kids will go over and say, hey, how you doing? You know, maybe they're a new kid at school. Mm-hmm. Friend them and make them feel part of the solution. But then you look for other kids. Maybe the grades are dropping. You know, Columbine was a classic example of Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. There were red flags everywhere. These kids were writing essays, their English teachers, and they were dressing in the goth, you know, and there were so many flags, but nobody really took it seriously and said, hey, maybe they are feeling a little bit isolated or alienated. Maybe they were bullied. You know, maybe it is cyberbullying. But there's a reason why those kids become disconnected. And we have to do a better job doing that.
Doctor, you say, some say, not you, but some say that despite the ready availability of guns, that guns are not the problem. If we banned guns, they said, and collected them all so that there were no guns available to average persons out there, other lethal weapons would fill the vacuum. Are they right? Would knives or bludgeons or baseball bats replace guns in these fatal altercations that come from the slightest, tiniest arguments?
Well, I think pragmatically, yes and no. The guns are easier to hide. Baseball bat, not necessarily as much. Knives would definitely be something that could be replaced, but the lethality is not the same as our you and our listeners know. So I think then you're still going to have to deal with this larger problem of how do you remove weapons, or how do you work with trying conflict management to reduce the use of violent weapons in conflict?
Are these weapons, are guns being used? Did you want to jump here, John?
I just want to say, you know, when you asked me prior too about when students, why do they have guns or why do they feel necessary, you know, it is part of having something that they feel is a power that could end a conflict if it escalates to a certain point. Having that makes them feel a little bit more of that power of, I've got control. So
is there plan B? Is that what you're telling me? If something gets out of control, at least I have this to fall back on?
That's, I mean, they're not going to say that, but the information that we gather in a lot of these cases.
Adults commit crimes with guns. They use guns to resolve conflict, but it seems to me that they don't do it as much as young people. Is that anecdotal? Is that my misreading of the situation, Doctor? Or is it something in an adult brain that switches at some point and they realize that there are other options and they're not quite as hot-headed?
Oh, there's definitely developmental differences between teens and adults. When you're in a conflict, then you're basically going to have your emotions that are going to be all over the place, and then you're going to have potentially maybe some cool-headed cognitive processes that are going to try to tell you to say, all right, stay in control. That's much harder when you are a teenager. In the teenage developmental periods, your emotions are much higher. Your empathy levels are much higher. Your fear is much higher. The prefrontal cortex regions of the brain that regulate more deliberate and controlled and rational thought don't reach their full development until the age of 25. So you don't have the capacity to engage in the same level of control as a teenager that you do as an adult.
Explain empathy. You just said their young person's empathy levels are higher. How does that translate? What does that mean?
So empathy is feeling what other people feel. And sometimes it's involuntary, but mm-hmm. we all have this capacity to feel what other people feel, when we go watch scary movies or go watch comedies or romantic comedies, so that we're going to feel what the characters are feeling. And this will be part of the goal of experiencing those events. When we are interacting with other individuals, our friends, we feel empathy. One of the reasons that you would have peer mediators would likely be more successful is because you actually have much higher empathy for groups that you identify with, your in-group. And so you're going to have much higher empathy for connecting with another fellow teen than you would with an adult who you view as an authority figure. So empathy is this connectivity, and teens have a very, very high connectivity to each other, and that's also something that they have to regulate.
So let me flip that coin, because Gary, you have said that when your student, Alex Orange, died, it literally changed your life.
Absolutely did change my life.
And you've devoted the rest of your life to making sure, trying to make sure this doesn't happen as frequently as it might have in the absence of organizations like SAVE. But in these situations, the perpetrator has his or her life changed forever. Everybody who knew the person who was affected by that bullet have their lives changed forever. If teenagers feel more empathy than adults, and they're more emotional about things, they see this. They see their friends' lives being changed forever. Their life, even if they're just a witness, has been changed forever. Why doesn't that deter them from having a gun in the first place? Because they can see the damage the carnage does to everybody.
Well, it's a simple fact that, back to the irrationality, Mike, irrationality, their emotions and feelings are overriding their ability to make a rational decision. And I guess they feel like they're backed into a corner and there's no way out. Peer pressure is something that can be a positive or a negative. And I like to think of peer pressure as more of a positive. And if you can rally a bunch of young people behind a common cause, it's a beautiful thing to watch. Yeah. But at the same time, when you've alienated some people, then you've got some negative peer pressure.
So a week and a half ago, we have a young person who kills another young person at Butler High School. The next day, we have a gun that shows up at Garinger. Yesterday, we have a gun that shows up at Hopewell. Mm-hmm. Why aren't these kids learning something from what happened at Butler? This is in their school district, right down the street. John.
In our schools, I mean, it's crucial that, yes, it happened, and what are we going to learn from it? Why are they not learning from it? I think there is a lot to learn from, and I think there is going to be a movement towards what are we going to do next? You know, how are we going to build communities in our schools that our students want to be part of? And if somebody harms that community, how are we going to help that child understand the harm that they have done, and how do we get the students to accept that child back into that community? That's part of that restorative process that, you know, CMS is so really interested in creating those restorative schools and restorative practices within.
Part of conflict management, which I just learned about this morning, would seem to me to be anger management. And what your grandmother, what our grandmothers all told us, count to 10 before you speak, count to 10 before you act, because that'll calm you down. You can slow things down and think about it before you. It's hard to do. How difficult is that to do, doctor, for young, you can jump in here, Gary, too, but how difficult, doctor, is that to do for young people? To slow down and think first.
It's much harder. And since their emotional reactivity can be higher, and they don't have their cognitive control is still in the process of being developed, it's harder to actually instigate that process. And to clarify an earlier point with regards to empathy, the empathy works on both sides of the equation in terms of the spreading of sort of fear and negativity that can give rise to some of the conflict in the first place, as well as afterwards the consequences and that sort of spreading of sadness and empathy towards the actual outcomes. And so both of those can happen. And in regards to that upfront control, that is something that is very difficult, and it needs to be taught and practiced. So if you were to have conflict management opportunities for students to practice, then you would actually need to engage in role playing to go through and say, hey, how would you do this and implement it?
Gary.
Yeah, two things real quick. Mrs. Orange said, after Alex was killed, she said to the young people, think twice, act once. Mm-hmm. That's great advice. And jumping on what she just mentioned about the role playing, what we did with elementary and middle schools is we actually role played situations like a fight over a ball in the playground or bumping into somebody in the hallway or the cafeteria. And they were able to role play that out. And then we rewind the tape after it was bad and say, how could we have handled it? So we were actually teaching those skills.
And we're going to talk about what skills can be taught and how you teach them and how well they can be learned by people who are still developing when we come back in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about conflict management and resolution and the use of guns and how you reduce that, particularly among young people who need to be taught about this stuff. And that comes from Gary Wirt, who is the co-founder of SAVE. He was a high school history teacher here in Charlotte when one of his students was shot, and he helped found SAVE, Students Against Violence Everywhere. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with John Councilman, bullying prevention specialist with CMS, and joining us by Skype is Dr. Sarah Levins, associate professor of psychology at UNC Charlotte. A lot of this carrying of guns is self-protective. It's motivated by fear and self-preservation. Why is it that some students have the kind of fear that they feel the need to bring a gun to school just in case, and others do not? John.
I think if it goes back to how do they, when they're coming to school, what is that community like that they're coming into? You know, is that community caring? Are they sharing? Are they helpful? Or is this community hateful towards one another, dehumanizing one another? And if they feel that they are needing to protect or feel safe, how do I do that in this environment?
And it's where they're coming from, not just what they're coming into. Catherine Seifert, who's a psychologist, she wrote in Psychology Today that there are many factors in a person's life that can contribute to someone resorting to violent behavior. She mentions maltreatment, chaotic neighborhoods, psychological problems, family bonding, intelligence, child development, peer relationships, and resiliency. This is incredibly complex. Given the complexity, where do you begin? Doctor.
Well, the earlier the better. I believe it was Gary was mentioning that you want to be starting with this conflict management in elementary schools, the early the better. When you are, by the time you reach high school, many of your habits are set. And the earlier you can target this, and there should be efforts with this. It shouldn't be relying on just the, you know, on just parents and just the schools. These need to be practiced across multiple scenarios. And that is going to lead to more effect or broader range of skill sets that can be applied in a range of scenarios.
You also talk about something called emotion contagion, that emotions mm-hmm. can spread between individuals because of the empathy component of all this. And it's particularly, as we talked about it in the last segment, particularly present among young people who have enhanced empathy and whose brains have not developed to the point of adult brains. But how much of this is also being spread? Well, we know it's being spread throughout society about our politics, but how much of this interpersonal emotional contagion is being spread by social media, where you're not getting the full picture, but you are getting the headline?
There's a lot of emotions are transferred through social media. And even aside from the social media that we might think about in terms of Facebook, through the social media platforms that they use, Snapchat, Instagram, there's very little content. And there's just key sort of communications of short pictures. It could be keywords that would be communicating to the individual that, hey, you need to sort of increase, you need to react, you increase your activity, you need to come in strong in response to this, in response to this perceived threat. And those are going to be things that are going to increase one's emotional response.
Yeah.
And interestingly, that if you're getting one of the things that they talked about in this particular circumstance was that the high school student had received multiple phone calls and text messages. So there's multiple forms of communication. And the more forms of communication there are, then there's more opportunity for this emotion contagion. And when you have these multiple forms, then they're going to reinforce each other. So if you're only hearing from one side, one angle, one social media platform, then that has one effect, but then that magnifies the more reinforcement you hear across the various communication strands.
Gary, you mentioned isolation and how your group has, what's it called? It starts with hello, is that?
Starts with hello.
How
and know the signs.
Students are encouraged, for instance, in the cafeteria, if they see day after day after day, this one student being sitting by him or herself, go over and sit down and have lunch with that person and say hello. And the words social media are not what those things are. They are very isolating forms of media, are they not?
Yes, they are. And that's one of the things that, you know, there's a terrible price we're paying for the technology, because some of these people that have acted out violently have literally grown up in an isolated situation, and their focus is that computer screen or their laptop or whatever, and they can pretty much find whatever it is they need to reinforce whatever feelings they have.
How difficult, because you've worked for how many years now on this?
30 years.
30
It'll
years.
Be 30 years in April.
How difficult is it to work with young people, to convince young people that there is an alternative, to give them the skills to use, when all they have to do is turn on the TV and see the antithesis of what you're trying to tell them?
It is very, very difficult, because they're getting a mixed message. And that's why we really need to empower the young people and let them be part of the solution and let them have a voice. Many of them see what you're talking about, and they're speaking out, and they're not very happy with what
they
see.
Well, the kids from Parkland point out the hypocrisy.
Amen.
Of all of this.
And I've met them. I do know.
And they've worked very hard to have an impact, and evidently the impact, at least within the state of Florida, wasn't completely successful. But they have made inroads on the hypocrisy, because people when it comes when the finger is wagged in the opposite direction, instead of adults wagging it at children and the children are wagging it back, you tend to get their you get the adults' attention.
Yes, you do. And I think those young people had some previous history. They grew up with some of the Virginia Techs and the Columbines, and, you know, they were more familiar with it. When Columbine happened, it was kind of like, oh, that's not supposed to happen there. That's an upper-middle-class neighborhood.
Right. And that was
a
Parkland.
Shock. And Parkland was the same thing.
Yeah.
But I think people are now getting the idea that it doesn't matter where you are. And there are no sanctuaries anywhere.
We live in a culturally angry society. We are deeply divided. Just before the election, we had these pipe bombs being delivered to people who were perceived to be enemies of the president. We have 11 people shot to death in a synagogue in Pittsburgh. Last night, we have 13 people that we know of at the moment killed in a bar we don't know why in California. Mass shootings happen almost every day. Our political dialogue on television and radio comes from the top down. It is angry. Yesterday at his press conference, it got really angry between the president and some reporters at that press conference. When you see this, when this behavior is being generated by the toddler in chief, what are children supposed to take from this?
I think Dr. Levin said it best. The younger that we work with these kids, I know my daughter who's in Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, every morning she comes in and she sits down in her classroom and has a morning meeting. She doesn't have social media. She doesn't have a phone yet. She doesn't. So we're able to get to her and her peers where there's a community that's being built. There's relationships that are being built at a young age that hopefully will carry over and build that empathy towards one another as they get older.
You're trying to work with young people in a school environment to tell them how they should behave, to give them alternatives to using a gun in a conflict situation. Mm-hmm. You're an adult figure. These kids are not stupid, and they're living in a world where they are seeing adults lie to them on a daily basis. Certifiable, verifiable, undeniable lies. Why should they believe you? You're an adult.
Yeah, that's a very difficult question to answer.
Gary.
The Parkland is a great example of young people that are seeing those and saying, hey, I'm not buying that. I am going to do what I can in my power, and let's get out and vote, and let's make changes, because it might take another generation, Mike, to turn it around. And that's sad, but I think we're on the right track.
So when you work with young people and you give them techniques and ways to do this, does that empower them, or does it put them at a disadvantage? Because if you're telling one person, and they take it to heart, and they try to act on slowing down, thinking twice, don't resort to a gun, find a way to manage our disagreement and walk away agreeing to disagree. If the other person has a gun in their pocket, aren't you putting those children at a disadvantage? How do you get them past that possibility?
Well, I don't think there's a magic formula. The earlier we get to them, the better. And that's what I was going to say with these role plays.
Mm-hmm.
When we started this program at West Charlotte High School in 1989, we went to other high schools. And then we went to middle schools. We got to the middle schools and we said, wow, these kids are well on their way. And then we went to the elementary schools. And the kids just realized that, you know, you take a 6'5" basketball player that slam dunks a basketball in the multipurpose room and then sits down on the floor and talks to young people, his message is going to be much better received than it is from an adult like me standing up there and doing it, because there's more of a disconnect with me. Mm-hmm. And the young people, they have to build trust, and that's a tough thing to do. But they will have some frustration, and it may not always turn out the way that you want. And, yeah, that's part of reality with life. But I think the more skills we give them, the more long-term prevention messages that we send. I taught history, Mike. I taught war. That's all I taught. I taught my kids Dorothea Day's peace essays and H.L. Mencken and Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from a burp, that wasn't in the curriculum. And I got in trouble a couple times because I deviated because I'm only supposed to teach this stuff. But like, no, and that's what's happening today. As a teacher, I was imparting values. Now it's all technology. The values are gone.
Yeah.
And the teachers don't have the time to do those quality things with their kids that they used to do.
Yeah. And that is, go ahead, John.
I think, you know, with Gary and save the SAVE chapters, instead of us adults speaking to the students, speaking at the students, it's about engaging them. It's about putting together platforms where we can engage them so that they can engage their peers, and we're helping them with that movement. We're not talking to them. We're not telling them, you know. And I think with the SAVE chapters and Students Against Violence Everywhere, once they start to understand how important it is, their voice and their knowledge of what's going on, not only in the schools but in the communities, and building communication between the young people and the adults in that building, and a trustful relationship to say, listen, there's a conflict that's happening in the neighborhood that's going to be spilling over into the school. We need to make sure that we're working together to de-escalate that and move forward before we have to, you know.
When should this this kind of training, this giving, and these are life skills, these are not just getting along together in school. These are life skills because you have to use these in the workplace. You've got to use it in your family life, et cetera. Absolutely. When should children get this? If they're not getting it at home, when should children get this information?
Elementary school. I had second graders that would paint their hands purple and orange, the colors of SAVE, and put their hands on a poster paper and then sign their name. And it said, Mrs. Smith's second grade class will not use these hands for violence.
Some people have complained because a lot of money has been devoted to research on young people driving. And the result of that research is the fact that young people have fewer accidents today than they did 25, 30 years ago. And they wonder why the same research has not been put into gun violence. Would that work? Or do we really have to put the money into emotional training, Doctor?
I think that you need to put it into both. And to add to when you should have some of this training occur, you should actually have the training occur at multiple time points. You should have it occur in elementary school, middle school, and high school. It should start early and it should continue, because as kids develop, then their capacity for understanding the depth of the situation changes, and you need to have these role-playing and conflict management opportunities and skill learning experiences at multiple stages. It should be something that becomes a part of, like, all right, you're moving into this, you know, into this stage now. You're going to be learning about this way to kind of control your emotions and to resolve conflict. If you get angry, what anger really means is that you desire for something to change. Mm-hmm. And that's what is occurring at our national level, and that's what is occurring at a interpersonal social levels in schools. So if you want something to change, then you need to learn how to do that and not use a gun.
And do we do this in our schools, John, or is it just troubled students that get this kind of training?
No, we do it all across our schools.
Okay. The more violence we witness, the more mass shootings that occur, the less shocked we seem to become, the more cynical we become about all of this. And I only have 30 seconds, Gary, but I would think that that leads to a lack of inertia to do something about it. Are we there yet?
No, we've got a long way to go. And I think the more that we can protect our most precious resource, which is our children, and we've got to make that our priority, and we don't seem to be doing that.
Gary Wirt, who used to teach in the school system here, drove up this morning from Charleston to be with us. Thank you for joining us, Gary. Gary's the co-founder of Students Everywhere, Students Against Violence Everywhere, SAVE. John Councilman, bullying prevention specialist with CMS, and Dr. Sarah Levins, associate professor of psychology at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.